You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, March 4th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Josh Brewer, labor organizer and representative of the Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union that is organizing the union push of Amazon in Bessemer, Alabama. Then we'll hear from Eric Levitz, senior writer at New York Magazine, on the state of the COVID relief bill in the Senate. Meanwhile, the House passes a landmark voting protection bill. The passage of that COVID relief bill was now likely going to happen in the weekend as Congress vacates for a day over the threat of a second Capitol attack. 7-day average of vaccinations tops 2 million people for the first time ever in this country, but experts fear a coming fourth COVID wave. Meanwhile, the Biden administration has quietly ceased drone attacks since the inauguration to reassess and rewrite Trump expansion, the rules of engagement. Georgia enacts Jim Crow voting restrictions. Alabama about to pass a law criminalizing any treatments for transgender youth. The International Criminal Court opens an investigation into war crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories dating back to 2014. And there are signs out of Kentucky that Mitch McConnell has begun to execute his exit strategy from the U.S. Senate. Lastly, Jim Jordan failed to report nearly $3 million in campaign funds. Also, just a reminder, not the first time he has failed to report. And ask some of his former wrestling students. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the program, ladies and gentlemen. Emma Vigeland, who is with me nearly every day, is not here today. She is out sick. Hopefully we'll be able to return tomorrow. Let's get right into it quickly. We have Joshua, I think, in the waiting room as it is now. But just want to mention and show this clip, Mondaire Jones explaining on the floor why passing H.R. 1. This is a very, very comprehensive voting rights bill, anti-corruption bill that was actually passed in the last session of Congress. Of course, it expired, so it needs to be passed in this one. It died in the Senate, never even got a vote, as far as I recall. That will not happen this time. Whether it passes is another question. Whether there is whether this brings about filibuster reform is also another question. Here is Mondaire Jones. He is from freshman congressman from New York 17th, explaining why this is a crucial bill for American democracy.
It's of foundational importance. We are, as you just described, experiencing in many parts of this country a new Jim Crow, where the modern day Republican Party has as its project not competing on the merits of its policy ideas, but the disenfranchisement of large swaths of the American electorate, like Black and Hispanic voters in southern states like Georgia and in Arizona. And so the For the People Act is common sense elections reform aimed at preventing the right to vote from being suppressed. It contains automatic voter registration, restrictions on voter purges, as you just described, public campaign financing so that we get better people elected to Congress who don't debate the need for $2,000 survival checks in the midst of the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. And of course, independent redistricting commissions so that QAnon conspiracy theorists like Marjorie Taylor Greene cannot coast to victory in general election contests simply because they have prevailed in their primaries.
And later, Mondaire Jones on that same program says it's time for the Senate to make a choice to finally provide some type of voting protection for people across the country and protection for our political system at large, revealing dark money, requiring states to have independent commissions for redistricting, cause tech platforms to disclose political advertising information. Finally, a code of ethics for the Supreme Court justices. They don't have one, incidentally. Restructure the Federal Election Commission so that it actually functions as opposed to just where it waves everything off and more. And here he is basically saying it's time for the Senate to make a choice. Either pass this landmark legislation, incidentally, that it may benefit and help Democratic officials get elected, but it's certainly going to help democracy.
And I've got to tell you, if the Senate does not move on this, not only will many of the people who are blocking progress in the Senate, who ran on things like a $15 minimum wage and delivering $2,000 survival checks to the American people, not get reelected, but it will have a ripple effect throughout this economy. We will spiral further into devastation. And of course, we have to pass the Equality Act in the Senate, and we have to pass the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act and a transportation and infrastructure bill, which we hope to pass in just a few weeks. And so we have to make sure that we are doing the things that we ran on, not adhering to old norms that have no place in the 21st century, like the filibuster, the Jim Crow relic that prevented so much civil rights legislation a generation ago, is now being used once again to block progress for the American people.
And we should say Amy Klobuchar, who is the chair of the Senate Rules Committee, where that bill will first go, the H.R. 1. And I imagine the George Floyd police reform bill, which gets rid of qualified immunity, as well as outlining some of the police tactics that are used. She yesterday reportedly, according to Ari Berman, said that she supports ending the filibuster at the very least to pass the For the People Act, which is the H.R. 1 and would be S1 in the Senate. So we will see. This is going to be the next big fight. We will be talking about Eric Levitz about the first big fight, which is the COVID relief bill, which is still ongoing, the debates. And we will be back in just a moment with Joshua Brewer, who is the labor organizer and representative of the Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union that is organizing workers in Bessemer, Alabama, to unionize an Amazon warehouse. We'll be back in just a moment. Folks, today's show is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Counseling. They're giving our audience 10% off their first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. Could be no better time, no greater need, no better way in which to access a therapist. But for BetterHelp, it gives you access to your own fully licensed and accredited therapist via phone, chat, or video. A lot of therapists, particularly now, I mean, in general, this is the case, but particularly now because of this pandemic is creating such stress, have long wait lists. And sometimes it can take you weeks. Sometimes it can take you months before you can see them. But when you sign up with BetterHelp, they match you with a therapist based on your specific needs, and you will be communicating with them in less than 24 hours. And one of the best things about that is not only will you be communicating with a therapist within 24 hours based on those needs, but if you find that you're not a good fit with that therapist, The beauty of BetterHelp is you don't have to wait another couple of weeks or months to schedule another appointment with a different therapist. If you don't think it's a good fit, you can switch to a new one at any time for any reason for no additional charge. They have thousands of licensed therapists from all over the country. They have therapists that have specialties that may not be available or readily findable in your area or frankly online for that matter. They also, BetterHelp tends to be more affordable than therapists you find through traditional means. You don't need to have insurance with BetterHelp. They also have financial aid options for those who qualify. This pandemic has been incredibly stressful for people. Very helpful to have a professional to talk to deal with this stress, whether it's sort of over a long-term period of time or even short-term. BetterHelp has given everyone in our audience 10% off your first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/majority report. We will put the URL in the video description if you're watching this on YouTube, and we will also put it in the podcast description. And as always, don't forget, it's your support that makes this show possible. I also just want to take the opportunity to say happy birthday to Hegemony Cricket, a longtime listener of the program. Here is a shofar. Six-year listener of MR, and just now figured out the ending lyrics to Pilot Light. So good for them. All right, I want to welcome to the show Joshua Brewer. He is a labor organizer and a representative of the Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union, the Mid-South Council. He has been organizing workers at Amazon in Bessemer, Alabama. Josh, welcome to the program.
Hey, brother. How are you?
I'm doing well. All right. People have been following this, obviously, across the country.
Sure.
Give us a sense, though. I mean, you know, we hear different stories about what it's like to work for Amazon. What are the Amazon workers in Bessemer in particular looking to improve? I mean, why are they looking to unionize?
Sure. I think, you know, ultimately workers reached out to us with late last summer, which is surprising being that this facility was opened in March of last year. So literally 3 to 4 months after the facility grand opened, they were reaching out to us. They had a tremendous amount of complaints, a lot of disorganization, overall just heat in the warehouse, you know, a variety of things, break times, being terminated for unjust reasons. But their overwhelming concern was just a lack of overall empathy or care for what their concerns or their desires were. They didn't know who to report their issues to. If they were having COVID concerns or COVID questions, there was nobody to answer them. Their emails went unanswered. They felt unsafe. Overall, they just felt underrepresented. I think that's really been a key word that's come up a lot throughout this campaign, is this level of representation or really advocacy, somebody that's on their side. We all know what Amazon is interested in, and that's getting those packages out the door. But I think workers really walked into this kind of overwhelming sense of just being disposable and being uncared for. And so it was really just about a variety of things that would really only come through somebody looking out for their needs.
Well, what is it about a Bessemer that sure. this is happening there? I mean, there's Amazon plant, and you know, I know there was an attempt in, I think it was Staten Island.
Sure.
I've lost track of time, but I feel like it was 9 months ago or somewhere around there. But what is it about Bessemer in particular that this is happening there as opposed to anywhere else across the country?
Sure. I think it's a particular time and space. I think if for those that are shocked or surprised that workers in Bessemer would organize, or even workers in the South would organize, you know, I would say that those folks haven't been paying good enough attention. I think the last, you know, handful of years, we've seen people rising up across this country. It's been no secret, you know, this facility is majority Black. And you've seen people across our country really recognizing the need to address some systemic issues and things that are going on in the Black community. And really have felt a sense of support from our country that I think they haven't felt maybe ever, right? Regionally, there's been a lot of division and things that have happened over the last 50 years, as everybody knows. And I think for these folks, this is really a time and place where they feel empowered by the nation. They feel like they have support of the nation. And therefore, you know, they've always been fighters. I think it just took a level of recognition that there was some problems and some pains here, and then some support to feel like, you know what, we're empowered to take on this fight ourselves, and that we can find real improvements and real lasting change that's contractual. I mean, the very idea of taking your labor back, taking the power of my own labor back and placing it into my community where we work and live, and making sure that our concerns are first. You know, we understand that Bessemer and cities where Amazon goes often eat a lot of tax breaks to subsidize these buildings. And ultimately, you know, look, this is a fight to say all that's well and good, but we have concerns, we have needs, and we have things that we want to see addressed.
And there's a bit of a tradition in that area, too, of unionizing. I mean, one wouldn't, at least in the modern era, one wouldn't have known that. But there's a strong tradition in union. In fact, Doug Jones, I think his, if I recall correctly, grandfather, maybe in mining, or there is some history there in terms of unionization.
Sure. It's actually fascinating. There was a steel unionized facility on the very grounds where Amazon sits. Right. And so this is a fight that was already taking place literally where they're standing for these same kind of things. And so Bessemer absolutely has long been a union, a deep union tradition. And again, Birmingham, Bessemer, this is all very conjoined together. Obviously, a deep history of civil rights activism, of fighting for positive change, and likely some of the hardest of circumstances. And so this is not the first time, and we don't think it's going to be the last.
Some of the reports I've heard out of Bessemer about from Amazon is like, well, you know, we pay, $15, $16 an hour. You know, how does that rate relative around there? Because I mean, and I think we'll go into sort of the working conditions there, right? I mean, this is a very difficult job. And in fact, I want to talk a little bit more about that, but in terms of just sheer pay, if I work at Amazon in Bessemer, am I getting, good pay or the best pay if I've just come out of high school, let's say?
Sure. I think, look, coming out of high school is one thing. I mean, obviously, we all had our first job. And I think when you look at our second job, and when you look at $15 an hour, that's what we're fighting as a nation to raise the minimum standard to. So I think when you look and when you ask me, is 15 or is wage really an issue with this campaign? It absolutely is. And it's a real issue simply for the fact that this is very difficult work. It's challenging work. And we're also living in a city environment with a city scaled economy. And $15 an hour is not particularly great inside of Birmingham and Bessemer area. Yes, the amount of jobs that were brought to Bessemer was great. But when you look at even warehouses that we have under union contracts here within 10 miles of this warehouse, similar warehouses with scales of $18, $19, $20 an hour coming from a small business. These are coming from local regional grocery warehouses or packing warehouses, and they're paying $18, $19, $20 an hour with 240 hours a year of sick time. To be honest, it's beginning to get offensive for me, where it's like the one question that continues to come up is, well, the $15 an hour. And what's amazing is the working people here are also getting offended because they say, listen, like, I'm kind of tired of people saying we should be grateful for $15 an hour because it's $29,000, $30,000 a year. And I don't know if you've ran a budget in a city environment with that kind of wages. Yes. Well, are we going to starve? No. Can we go to the beach this year? No. No. Can we get the nice cleats for the softball league? No. No, we got to go buy the hand-me-downs or the thrift stores. So this is not a wage to be celebrated. Amazon has really tried to run that across the country. And it's amazing to me because in an economy like the South, where wages are obviously lower, we still are struggling to make it on $15 an hour, right? And so I think you were alluding to it. You add in the level of work and how difficult the actual taxing of the nature of the job. 15 is actually the lowest that I could even find in this area.
When you talk about those regional warehouses for local supermarkets, just out of curiosity, the CEOs of those, Are they making billions upon billions of billions of dollars over the course of COVID? I mean, I'm just curious if any of those regional warehouses have owners who are saying, I don't know what to do with my money. I may have to figure out a way of going to Mars so I can spend it. I'm just curious.
No, it's pretty incredible, actually. I think you know the answer, and it's a great question. I mean, these folks are, look, we sit down with some of these smaller businesses and regional businesses, and we negotiate these contracts. And they open up their books, and they say, you know, here's the books. Here's what we made last year. Look, I started this business. I'd like to make a little more than the employees. Obviously, that's understandable. And so we look at that, and then we do common sense wage increases, make sure that their employees are taken care of. Everybody shakes hands. They've got happy employees. They make plenty of money. It's a functioning society. Amazon just doesn't want to participate in that, to your point, because $75 billion a year profit for one man is nice.
We've been talking a little bit about some of the anti-union tactics that Amazon's been deploying, something like $25 million worth of anti-union tactics, including changing the timing of stoplights so that organizers aren't able to talk to their fellow workers. Mm-hmm. But there's also been a program of where they have hired, and my understanding is that most of the upper management there are white. They have hired anti-union consultants who are black to meet one-on-one with workers in the factory. Tell me about that dynamic. I'm curious about it.
Yeah, sure. So, they've had union busting consultants there since, you know, really November, slowly after they realized that their workers were organizing and it was really grabbing root. And I think, to your point, upper management, generally very white, union busters have been majority black. But when the ballots actually went out, they had to stop the captive audience meeting. So first they were forcing everyone to come into like a classroom style meeting and really like teach them, you know, about the union, right? Which I think is interesting. They even formulated it as a class. And so they were teaching about the union. If an activist would, they'd call us and they'd say, listen, they're lying. They're saying all you're going to force us to pay union dues. And can I throw this meeting? Say, well, that's your choice. You can ask questions. And so a union activist will stand up and ask a question. They're called to the front of the room. They take a picture of their ID. They're removed from the meeting. You're no longer allowed to participate. That's the kind of environment that's been created there. It's almost now you're cast out. It's like everybody wonders, ooh, like, where are they going? You know, like, where are they sending them? Right. I mean, it's bizarre. And I think once they had to stop those classroom meetings, now they legally can still do one-on-one interactions. And so at $3,200 a day, which is what each consultant is being paid, that's filed on their LMs. So they're paying each one $3,200 a day.
Wow.
To approach 6,000 workers on a one-on-one basis, how many of those consultants must they have going around that facility? So they'll approach them with water and candy, and they'll basically just interrogate them on their, you know, in creative ways to try to figure out if they're a supporter or not.
Wow. $3,200. I mean, I think people should understand. Well, let's hold that for a moment. The one other thing I just read in Mike Elk's Payday report, that one of the things that they're trying to do in busting the union or convincing people not to vote for it is to sort of wedge between older and younger workers. Mm-hmm. I come out of high school, and you know, there's a sort of a almost like a warrior mentality that you need to have to work at a place like this because it's so physically taxing.
Right.
How much is that, you know, at play? Like, how are they sort of like stoking that?
Sure. No, I think it's real. It's been an effort on their part to really confuse younger workers with this idea that, to your point, and they have to work very quickly. Everything is tracked. Their production is tracked. If you want to make it to the top of the ladder, you got to have the best production. And so, as we know, we were probably at our best physically producing selves at 18, 19, 20 years old.
Yeah, as far as I can remember.
But yeah. Right? And so it's this idea that when the union comes, the union is going to promise things based on seniority. And they're gonna ask that increases in promotions are based on seniority because, yes, in fact, unions believe that there should be something given to the person that was loyal and give you the best years of their life. that you would in turn take care of them in maybe not their best years. I think that's not that radical of a thought. But yeah, so that is a union thought. But we've had to walk back and explain to younger workers that, listen, there's always ways to improve and exceed beyond seniority. If you look at nearly any union contract, the language is simply the most senior employee also with the ability to perform the job, right? And so there is some reasonable lines here that are drawn, but that, you know, look, these older workers that are slow, they're going to stand in the way of your progress and you moving forward. And, you know, ultimately, obviously, that is a wedge, and they're trying to really drive that home.
How much has COVID played into this, both? And I think you've already touched on this maybe a little bit in terms of, like, you know, what it has brought about, right? I mean, it, you know, there's far more intense, far more danger, like literally, you know, sure, health danger in the course of a pandemic. How has it made organizing more difficult from your perspective?
I would say the difficulty is with any movement, especially like this, which was truly just unbelievable how fast and exciting and engaged people were and really took ownership of this and the community and everybody that's involved. I think that when you look at that feeling of camaraderie or people really gathering in large groups, we miss that. You know, it's very important to really have that kind of feeling. You know, in an environment like Amazon with COVID, there's no large break area where workers gather and talk. There's none of this really, you know, even to the simple part of organizing a party. People have parties, work parties after work, and then workers come and gather and they talk about the union and they talk about different things. And there's really this dynamic that's missing with COVID. I think that's for a lot of us, but it's really bled into organizing too, where you are missing that kind of connection. You know, we can't even rent meeting spaces to even host people. And so much of it has been done virtually, over the phone, you know, in communities and parks, open spaces, but really missing that kind of closeness. I think that has affected the organizing. But on the same level, I think workers also were more apt to organize when they learned through COVID that their employers don't really care about their safety. So I think on one hand, it spurred organizing. On the other hand, it's certainly a challenge.
I mean, I imagine you do, if you're doing the Mid-South Council organizing, you know, you're probably more used to organizing in a so-called right to work state than anything else. How does that play in? I mean, the idea of, because, you know, I've been curious in the wake of Janus, what the implications have been for public sector workers, where there's no, you know, like the resistance to a union. One of the big, you know, pitching points they used to say was like, you're going to have to pay,
right,
and they're going to take a big chunk out of your check. And that's not the case, because you're not forced to pay even agency fees. You're doing work. You got lawyers who are going to organize, who are going to negotiate a better deal. Maybe it's more cash. Maybe it's also better breaks, et cetera, et cetera. You're not going to work in a steam house.
Right.
Somebody's got to pay them, but they're not required to. So how does that make your job easier on some level, or how does that come to play?
Sure. I think it's just different. You know, I've been asked this a lot, and I really had to kind of think about what it would be like to organize in a non-right to work state and what that would look like. Look, the law is designed to weaken unions. It's designed to weaken unions in the fact that it's very time consuming. Even if all employees, which has been our experience, once we organize a shop, we bring good benefits, we bring good representation, majority of employees join. It's not really that big of a problem. But the problem comes from having to literally the time it takes to go and fill out. Everybody individually has to have these different forms and different joining things. And it, as with high turnover facilities, it really creates a tremendous amount of just overall burden on the union to keep up with it. Most workers, again, in our experience, join the union. And so, you know, when it comes to organizing, you know, look, if we weren't right to work, we'd have stronger unions and we'd have more ability to organize bigger and better. And so, you know, does it help in some ways to maybe say, hey, you know, there's not as much of a commitment up front. We can kind of show you what we can do, and then you can make that decision. I think that might help. But overall, when you look at the negatives to it and how much it really weakens what we're able to do as far as being able to organize on bigger and better scales. You know, obviously it's not an advantage, I think, by any stretch of the imagination, but it can be, you know, in some ways, certainly. Amazon has very much tried to misinform workers and say that they're going to have to pay those agency fees and they're going to have to pay dues. But it's just, again, they've told a lot of lies. So it's nothing new.
I'm not terribly shocked by that.
Yeah.
To be honest. What's interesting about this and why people should care across the country is because Amazon, and you tell me if I'm wrong, but I can't imagine that Amazon, like I say, the billions of dollars that are just, you know, they're that are just flowing through them, that they really care that much about what happens in one warehouse in Bessemer, Alabama. What they care about is if it happens in Bessemer, what happens in Bessemer does not stay in Bessemer. Right? Like if there's one, if there's one place in the country where unionization works, then they're very nervous about that, right? I mean, they're not spending $25 million and putting people on the floor who have, you know, $3,200 a day because they're worried about this, you know, paying an extra buck to, you know, just these workers. Is that right?
No, you're spot on, Sam. You're spot on. Amazon, look, I'll tell you what really Amazon, the beautiful thing about this is it's too late for Amazon. What Amazon was terrified of already happened. And that was that the federal government would certify an election at one of their warehouses, because it shows unequivocally, scientifically, that over 2,500 or 2,700 of their own workers wanted to form a union, as verified by the federal government. Okay. And that was the fear the whole time, because once it became public that this isn't some disgruntled workers, this isn't some, you know, groups over here that are just coming after Amazon. This is a very real systematic problem between Amazon and the relationship with their workforce. And once that became known on a real scale like it has now, I think the organizing activities are going to pop up all over the country, and not just at Amazon, all over. And so I think that is what they were afraid of. I think that is how you go from 2,000 employees to 6,000 employees in the matter of 3 months. I think that is how you do all the things they've done to try to, like you said, to try to stop this ever from becoming even to this place. Because a coin flip election is too close for Amazon's comfort. They can't even stand the thought of a coin flip. And so, you know, I'm excited and encouraged because A, I believe we're going to win this campaign. But B, I believe we've already accomplished what Amazon did not want to happen. And that is simply proving that their employees want a union. Whether they, you know, illegally or legally try to stop this from happening, you can't argue that they wanted a union. And so that's the problem for Amazon.
Well, you just answered my question, one of my last questions, which is, are these guys going to get, and women, are they going to get a union?
I think they are. I think they are. We're seeing an incredible amount of excitement, momentum. You know, it's never, and we've never said that we felt like we would win this election on a landslide simply because of a lot of the tactics Amazon has done. But this has always been a very real, very exciting campaign with thousands of workers that really want a union. And so we feel like we're going to win. We definitely do.
And just to clarify, how many votes do you need? Like, you don't need, you need just a majority of the people who vote, right? Not a majority of the people in the shop.
Correct. Yeah. Majority vote. So, you know, obviously we're expecting a pretty good turnout with just the polarity of the campaign and with the amount of excitement we have on our side. We're expecting a large turnout. But with, you know, it's simply just a plus one. So if there's for math, if there's 1,000 votes, whoever gets 501 wins, and you win the entire unit, which also speaks to, again, Amazon's desperation up front to stop the actual certification, that they were willing to offer up the entire warehouse to be organized. And so if 501 workers in that scenario voted, all 6,000 workers would become union workers. And so they really went full throat to stop it. And now we'll see if it pays off on the back end, but we think we're going to win.
And the I think there's 3 more weeks to vote. And lastly, I'm in New York State. What do I, if I want to help in any way, what do I do? Is there anything I can do?
Look, as crazy as it is, social media is a real tool. I mean, it's a real tool that creates buzz, sharing things that are going on, sharing articles that are being written by journalists, sharing shows like this, getting the message out really is a tool that people can use in solidarity, because what it does is it creates so much buzz that then it kind of brings other people out to the forefront that should have been involved. And so, you know, look, I think having the president of the United States, having these different sports organizations and political figures and now community leaders, and all of that was created by the buzz of just regular people saying, yo, everybody should pay attention. There's a real thing going down in Alabama. That's what created this. And now we have teams of hundreds of volunteers on the ground that have come down and rented up every Airbnb in town just to offer their help. I mean, it's a full blown battle for these last 3 weeks, and it's going to be fun. It's exciting. And we think we're going to bring it home.
Good luck. Joshua Brewer, organizer, representative from the Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union. Thanks so much for your time, man. Good luck.
Thank you.
All right, folks. Let's just roll right in. Do we have Eric? Bring in Eric Levitz. He is senior writer from New York Magazine. Eric, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You wrote a piece right now. I guess they've pushed off the vote by a day or two because there's still some negotiation. Give us a state of play as far as you know it, as to where the bill is. We're talking about the COVID relief bill. This is the $1.9 trillion bill. What is the state of play right now with the bill?
My understanding is that they're basically trying to appease some remaining moderate objections. And then also, I believe that the big thing is that I don't believe the CBO score has been completed yet. All the $1.9 trillion number, that's, an estimate by the Biden White House. It's possible that they overshot, that they appropriated more, that the largely Republicans who staff the CBO might find that actually these programs are more expensive than Democrats estimated, in which case, because they set the ceiling for their reconciliation bill at $1.9 trillion, they may need to revise things down, shift things from one committee to another. But my understanding is they're in this kind of, reconciliation, rules compliance plus moderate appeasement stage.
Can you help us like just explain that to people? Because I think that people don't fully understand that point, that they set a number first because they have this sort of vague notion. I mean, this is a very bizarre way of doing things, right?
Yeah.
But they set a number, and presumably that's like, hey, we've got this thing we're going to sell on TV. Let's make it $39.99 because, it doesn't sound like $40, but it basically is. And we'll get them on the shipping and handling or whatever. But they say they set the number $1.9 trillion. There's a resolution that the Senate passes that says we're going to pass a bill that is $1.9 trillion big. And then they go and figure out how they're going to fill that up. And then they're not sure if they've filled it up to the right level. So it's conceivable, but unlikely based upon who's staffing the CBO at this particular time, that they could have extra room in those buckets, right? Will you just, but also just delineate for us how it works with the different committees as well?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a huge expert, but yeah, basically there's a further complication, which is that not only do you have a ceiling on the whole bill of $1.9 trillion, but within that, each committee is assigned its own cap on how much it can spend. And so, and because certain provisions fall under the jurisdiction of some committees, but not others, that complicates, if you do need to make adjustments, you can't, you don't have total flexibility because you can't just take from one committee or whatever. And then the other aspect of it is, one thing the CBO scored, the minimum wage is actually increasing the deficit, contrary to what Sanders argued. So that coming out ostensibly creates some space that wasn't anticipated. It's not entirely clear, how the CBO is going to score everything. And so it is possible that they'll find they have extra room. But my understanding is, part of the reason for what I was writing about the motivation behind caving to moderates on the eligibility for the checks was that, maybe we could use a little more headroom. anyway. So
I want to get into that in a moment.
Yeah.
When the CBO scored the $15 minimum wage, you know, and like you say, Sanders had multiple studies that showed it would actually add revenue to the budget. But the CBO score says that it was going to cost $64 billion over the course of 10 years, right? This is the 10-year horizon is my understanding.
That's the number I remember. Yeah.
And so when that comes out, does Sanders, who as the chair of the budget committee, if the $15 minimum wage was in his silo, his jurisdiction, if you will, his little sort of fiefdom, does he look around and say, okay, well, what can we now, because we have been, as the budget committee, essentially granted X percentage of that $1.9 trillion, let's just say for the sake of math, like, you know, $500 billion. Now we have $64 billion to play with. Does he say, okay, we're going to raise one of these other things, or, hey, you know, you senator from West Virginia, you're on my committee. What, you have anything that you think could cost $64 billion? I mean, is that the way this works?
Yeah, well, I think it would, you know, hypothetically. I'm realizing, you know, because we're operating from, if Sanders went into this process thinking that the minimum wage is actually a revenue raiser, then perhaps the initial like package of things that they were planning to do through the budget committee might actually be, you know,
it might
higher.
Be less so that, headroom, in fact.
Right. Yeah.
Because he had thought there was more headroom because this was going to bring revenue in. And these, and just to be clear with everybody, you need to hit that $1.9 trillion. You can't go over it. And certainly you don't want to go under, because you've already, you know, everybody thinks you're passing something for $1.9 trillion. You can't go over it. And he thought that was going to offset the expenditures. So he may have.
Right. So that falling out may actually give him less headroom. But you know, yeah, what you described as the process, if in fact, you know, there turns out to be extra space, then the committee can decide to put more money into one bucket or another.
So, all right, let's talk about this that you wrote about, I guess it was just yesterday, that the moderate Democrats, and when we say moderate Democrats, a handful of moderate Democrats, you wrote, like, who are we talking about? Do we know?
Well, it looks like Joe Manchin and Jeanne Shaheen from New Hampshire were the most vocal, I think, about supporting this particular provision. I would guess that, I believe that Kyrsten Sinema had made noises about the eligibility, but I'm not 100% on that. But Manchin, certainly this was a big cause for him to target the checks to a certain extent more.
Okay. Now, I can on some level, Joe Manchin makes a little bit more sense as to why he doesn't see a cost associated with this, I think. I mean, so just tell us exactly what happened. There are these $1,400 checks. Many people feel that they should be $2,000 checks just because that's what they were told they were going to be when they voted in Georgia. And we should just remind people, they were told that after the $600 checks had passed. So there was no asterisk when people were saying $2,000 minus, of course, $600 that already passed last month. That never happened. But $1,400 checks. And the question is, who is eligible for these checks?
Right.
So tell us how it changed.
Yeah. So the Biden White House from the beginning was pretty hardline in terms of the income limits at which, you know, up to that limit, you get your $1,400. And that's been fixed for a while at 75 for an individual, 150 for a couple. And the difference is that you had a previously in the House version, a phase down such that, you know, you make $75,000 a year, you get $1,400 from the government. You make $80,000 or, you know, $81,000. You probably get, I don't have it in front of me, but, you know, like $1,200 or $1,100. And it's slowly the amount that you get from the government phases down until it, I believe, phased out at $100 for individuals and $200 for couples, I believe.
Yes.
And so what they've done, because the Biden White House is like pretty firm on those limits in terms of, you know, we want people who make 75K to get the 1400. They've just rapidly altered the phase down such that if you make $75,000, or you're going to get a $1,400 check from the government. And also like a $1,400 check, for I believe it's also that for your children. You're going to get a pretty big payday. Whereas, but if you make $80,001 a year, you're going to get zero. So the structure of it is such that it's not actually something that actually appeals to like moderate wonks. So like you have the PPI, I think the Progressive Policy Institute, the sort of Orwellian named they're really to the right of third way at this point, sort of in terms of being fiscally responsible Democrat think tank. I think his name is Ben Ritz, I think, from them, was expressing anguish at the experience of if you just had let the ideologues have their way, they would have had a better policy, because this is the kind of thing that moderates are supposed to hate. Like, this discourages work, right? I mean, if you're in a position where you can work a few more hours, but that's going to bring your salary or your yearly annual income from right. 75 to 80,000, you're suddenly going to pay 70% tax on your last $5,000 of income, and it's not going to be worth it to you. So I don't know exactly how realistic, how many people are actually going to find themselves in that position, but this is just not something that even centrist wonks think is a good idea.
Right. I mean, it's both politically, it seems stupid, and it also, from a policy standpoint, because there's such a steep cliff and there's such a binary, it's so binary as opposed to a slow ramp down. How many millions of people are not going to get a check from Joe Biden, but did get one from Donald Trump?
Yeah. So it looks like from one estimate, it's going to be 12 million adults and 5 million children. I believe pretty much everyone who got a full check from Trump is going to get a full check from Biden. But, you know, a lot of people who were poised to get, a $1,000 check. And again, it really multiplies because the one, defense or flip side with the 1400 versus 2000 is that, for families with children, right? I think the median family of four is going to get actually like a $5,600 check, because you get one for each. So it's a really big payday if you're eligible. And now you're in a situation where, a lot of people who are going to get quite a bit of money are not. And in some cases, these are people who, took a second job last year to try to really get, to help out with their family, to get their income up. And now they're finding, holy shit, I worked all those hours for nothing, because it actually is going to like cost, practically almost cost me money to have worked that. So there's potential for resentment. There's potential for backlash. And the bottom line is that there's just it just doesn't do anything productive. This is, according to one Democratic aide, this is expected to save $12 billion. So that is 0.063% of the overall package. It's nothing. I mean, it's just nothing.
And we should say there's two things I want to say. The only sort of counterbalance in terms of the number of people who are getting checks is that in this round of checks, adult dependents of people who make under $75,000 will be getting checks. And that is, I've seen estimates around 24 million people. I would imagine that estimate was based upon the other income threshold, so it's probably a little bit lower, but you're still talking about an extra maybe 15, 20 million people. And for people who are, who have more of a burden, lower income. But that said, as a political matter and as an economic matter and as a policy matter, still really stupid to do. We should also say that yesterday when Emma and I were talking about this, we were making that point about like this is pegged towards 2019 or 2019 income. If you lost your income in 2020, we said incorrectly that you were out of luck, because the fact is that you do not have to file your taxes before this bill gets passed to be eligible to get the payment. It's just a question of timing. If you can now file, if you made in 2020, much less than you did in 2019, and you're eligible, you can file. We will put a link to that in the description where the IRS has this, but you can be eligible. It's just a question of timing as to whether you will get it because you haven't filed your taxes. But once you do, you can use your 2020 income as a baseline if you made much less, which I think a lot of people did in 2020 than in 2019. So why? Like, explain to us why you would do this if you're talking about an infinitesimally small amount of money relative to $1.9 trillion, like what is Joe Manchin, like what is his deal? What does he get out of this?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that I was kind of struggling with, because a lot of the things that we normally resort to explain the behavior of moderates like don't seem to apply here. You know, obviously, this is a very popular policy. There's not really a strong political incentive to do it. For someone like Jeanne Shaheen in New Hampshire, you know, who the Democratic coalition there now is pretty upper middle class. She's targeting, you know, her own constituency, who, as I noted, she's gone to bat for previously by being a very staunch defender of the SALT tax deduction, the state and local income tax deduction, which overwhelmingly benefits, you know, fairly wealthy families. You know, it's a form of kind of middle class welfare, you know, to a more egregious extent than these checks are. So it doesn't really make sense from a political lens in terms of, you know, either polling or their own constituencies, maybe Manchin a little bit more, but still not that much. It's not really like, it's not like Wall Street is pushing for more limited checks here. There's kind of been a come to MMT moment among a lot of, you know, people in the financial community. I mean, you know, it's bidding up the price of the assets that they own, and large retailers love these stimulus checks. They've seen really big sales. So it's not a corporate thing. And they've already committed themselves to voting for what's going to be a roughly $1.9 trillion package, you know, over the objections of some center-left technocrats like Larry Summers. So it's not even like they're getting austerity points. Like, it's basically just, it seems like just to do it, just for the sake of saying that we, you know, we forced liberal Joe Biden to give some way. I think they're just fixated on this idea of targeting the checks, and they wanted to say they got it. They got something.
I don't even understand how that's articulated. I mean, I suppose like I could see Joe Manchin going to certain parts of West Virginia and going like, I'm not going to have somebody who's making $100,000 get a check from the government. Yeah. I mean, I suppose I can see that. Like you say, Jeanne Shaheen would be, you know, far tougher, I think, in you know, in many respects for her to get away with doing that. But, you know, like it's just part of their branding that they just want to be able to say, we got something. Couldn't they find something else?
Yeah, you would think. And the thing, I mean, but again, it's like, it's such a small amount of money that they're saving. It's not like they're going to, you know, I could almost respect if Manchin said, look, I want, you know, 2-3 more months of enhanced unemployment benefits. And I want to, you know, limit. I mean, I don't agree with that, but it's just like, at least there's like a logic there. I don't see what it is here. And I've also wondered lately, you know, about that with a $15 minimum wage, you know, which is, it's like phased in after 4 years. So if you think about like what the demand was in 2013, I just wonder whether like, is this actually related to any kind of calculation of like, okay, the prevailing wage in my state is X and I'm comfortable X times that, or is it just like literally like we could be here a decade from now and it's like 11, 12 is the moderate position, 15 is the left position. You know, I just wonder whether this is totally superficial, whether actual policy beliefs
underneath.
It has to
be totally superficial. Yeah. West Virginia has an 88% median, I think, wage. 88% of the median wage is there. I mean, the way that this would roll in over time, we are overdue for $15 across the country. We're late on the $15. Never mind the 4 years out. I'm saying today. And it is. It's baffling and it's disturbing. All right, we just have a minute or two left. There are a couple of other things that seem to be extant. I know there was an attempt by some so-called moderate senators. Maybe they gave that up and they just got their scalp for whatever it is that we've been able to sort of deny people who make $80,000, you know, any bit of a check. You know, I don't know why they can't use that scalp that we got a $1,400 check as opposed to $2,000, which was promised. But what else is happening? I know that Wyden and I think Sanders are trying to get automatic stabilizers into the bill. Is that possible? Does that get scored in a way that makes it impossible? What's the story with that to the extent that you know?
I haven't been following the latest push that closely, but I know that in the past, that's been the big issue. That's why in the HEROES Act, even, you know, when that was largely a messaging bill, and when that was at a time when, you know, Democrats had reason to fear that this would be their last bite of the apple, that Republicans would keep the Senate, and then Biden would be presiding over this economic crisis that McConnell would refuse to help with. So there was a really strong incentive to get automatic stabilizers, which is to say enhanced unemployment benefits automatically kick in when the unemployment rate is below a certain threshold. We don't need to rely on Congress to do its job. It's just going to happen. There was very strong incentive to do that. Pelosi didn't do that at the time because CBO would have scored it. It would have been very expensive the way the CBO scores it. And again, with this superficial thing we're talking about, a lot of Democrats are afraid of large numbers. So,
and we're anticipating a vote on Saturday for this bill.
I think that's the last I heard. Yeah.
All right. Well, Eric Levitz, thank you so much. If you ever, ever figure out what Joe Manchin is doing here, I mean, he's got a, his Republican governor was complaining about lack of $2,000 checks. And presumably at the same sort of like income spectrum as the other checks were. So I just can't, I'm just at a loss by this. It's like Pete Peterson put something in the water before he died. And Joe Manchin still has like a big jug of it in his fridge or something. Eric Levitz, senior writer from New York Magazine. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate
Thank you.
All right, folks, quick break. We'll be right back. Wrap things up. We are back. Got just a minute here. There's been some talk that, and people understand, the bill originates in the House. It heads over to the Senate. If the Senate materially changes it, which they will, I mean, it's not going to be the exact same bill. This income spectrum difference is enough that it has to go back to the House and pass. And then when that is... when the bill is the same in both houses, may they get to conference, they make sure they iron that out, and that's when it becomes law. There is an opportunity for folks in the House, progressives, to say, not voting for this. And then presumably it would go back into some type of negotiation. There is a March 14th deadline for a lot of unemployment. A lot of people have lost unemployment already, but a massive, or I should say the expansion of unemployment is going to end as of March 14th. And there has been a concerted effort to get this bill done in time to replace that expansion. But we could be at one of those, what's good for goose gander type of situations. We shall see. I don't know. There's a much bigger cost associated, I think, for people who want this aid to reach people to vote against the bill than for people who are less concerned about this aid reaching people to vote for the bill. But I guess we will see as to how that's assessed by the progressives in the House if this ends up being the final bill that comes out of the Senate. All right, we will talk more about this tomorrow, and we will see you then. If you missed any part of the show, check us out on Peacock, Choice app. Find us, the Peacock app, Choice Channel, 5 p.m. and 10 p.m. We'll see you tomorrow. And for those of you who we won't see tomorrow, but in fact, we will see today, stick around for the fun half of the program. This is where on the IRS page you can find information on the recovery rebate credit. So in other words, if you didn't, you may not be eligible for a check right now if you haven't filed your 2020 taxes. But once you do, you will get a rebate and you will get that check. You will get what is coming for you. They knew that was a problem. And that's at irs.gov/newsroom/recovery-rebate-credit. Again, irs.gov/newsroom/recovery-rebate-credit. And that is a care of listener Joe Buck yourself. Yep. So what an audience we have. Somebody who's Joe Buck yourself basically is telling everybody how to make sure that they get that credit if they're eligible for it. It's unbelievable the small amount of money that is going to be saved in terms of this bill, and then and how much of a difference it would have made to literally millions of individuals. $1,000, if you're making $85,000, is still a significant amount of money. I mean, after tax, it's still talking like, I don't know, I can't do the math in terms of percentage of your income, but that's extremely helpful. Folks, don't forget, it's your support that makes the show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. It is your support that makes this show possible. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Make sure you check out Nomi's show today, youtube.com/thenomikeyshow. Or twitch.tv/the_NomiKey_show. I think that's the best I've ever done with that. Also, there he is. I was waiting to see who's going to pop up first. Old Matt is here. Somebody just on the IM said, ask old Matt about the incest thing. Do I want to?
I honestly don't know what that's referring to. The you incest
know
thing.
I am glad that you don't know what that is referring to. So I'm going to ignore that. I am. What's happening on Doomed these days, Matt?
Well, Sam, first I want to say a happy inauguration day to you today. Today's the big day, March 4th. Donald Trump's coming back into office. We all know this is what's going to happen for sure.
He rises, right? Wasn't he stuck in a cave? Wasn't he down in Mar-a-Lago and they put a rock in front of it and then he rises up or something like that? Do I have the holiday right?
I think you got two of them a little bit confused, although, you know, they would, I think certain people would actually enjoy that one.
And then he leaves chocolate eggs everywhere.
Right. Yes. That's okay. That is Donald Trump, right?
You need some Gentiles to explain this.
Yeah. Right. I'm not sure I follow this.
Well, anyway, today on Doomed, youtube.com/Matt Binder live at 9 p.m. Eastern time. Maybe go a little bit early today, too, but for sure at 9 p.m. Eastern time. We are going to run through the current conspiracy theory in QAnon world that says that today, March 4th, 2021, you know, just a few months after Joe Biden was inaugurated the president of the United States, supposedly, Donald Trump will just give him the boot and be re-inaugurated and become president today.
This is the old inauguration day, right?
Today is the old inauguration day. Yes. Like years back, I think the right. last president inaugurated on this date was Grant. So right. That would make Donald Trump the 19th president of the United States today when he gets re-inaugurated. Because the conspiracy goes further, and I'm giving it all away now, but the conspiracy goes further and states that every
spoiler
president...
Spoiler alert! Don't do
every
it!
President
don't give it away!
From Grant till now has not been legitimate. But, you know, we'll get to that more tonight.
Well, YouTube.com. There's a good argument about that.
YouTube.com/Matt Binder for the live stream, and then after that, if you want to catch the audio version of the show, it'll be up at doomedpod.com.
Jamie, what's happening on the Antifada?
Well, this week on the Antifada, we have a very exciting episode with African-American studies professor Toussaint Lozier, as well as a member of the Chicago Black Panther Party, Bradley Green, who was a contemporary of Fred Hampton's, to talk about the movie Black Panther. Just kidding. The movie is Judas and the Black Messiah, which is about Fred Hampton and how he was murdered by the police and the FBI. And it's told through the eyes of a snitch. And I'm really excited about this episode. It was amazing to get to talk to an OG Black Panther. And I hope that everybody listens to it.
Yeah, I'll just say I listened to it yesterday afternoon. Absolutely great amount of wisdom coming from those folks. And I think if one thing comes from that movie, which I must say I did enjoy, but I appreciated the critique in that episode. But if one thing does come from it, it's more of those people being heard, I think.
Yeah, for real. It always makes me feel really good to talk to older revolutionaries, because if they still have hope, it means that I should too. You know, this is someone who watched his comrades get murdered and he still has hope. And not only that, like, it gives me a sense that we actually do know what to do. We just have to do it. And I came away from this movie and this interview feeling like very inspired to keep on doing the work.
Folks can check that out. Patreon.com/TheAntifada. Matt, what's happening? New Matt. What's happening in the Matt Leckian audio and video universe?
Yeah, tonight on Left Reckoning on the YouTube page and on Twitch, Austin Gonzalez of Machete y Mate, my Spanish pronunciation is just not great, is going to talk to us tonight about Ecuador, Haiti, and kind of Latin American politics broadly. Is there another coming of the pink tide, particularly if Arauz wins in Ecuador? So that tonight, 8 o'clock on the YouTube page, Left Reckoning, patreon.com/LeftReckoning to get the post game.
All right. These guys, will see you in the fun half. I'll be back on Friday.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You get nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
That's some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27, 1 half, 5 eighths, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance. My first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.